tried to make me go to rehab, but I said no, no, no.
Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tymie Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, rehabilitation. Hello, and thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Hey. So, my daddy tried to make me go to rehab, but I said no. Nice. Thanks for joining in there. Yeah.
I thought about that song.
Yeah, but we're going to talk about rehabilitation today, and this one is kind of a sequel to our Get Tough on Crime episode.
Good.
Yeah, and in that episode, I briefly mentioned the Nothing Works report in ideology, so that might be a good place to start with Nothing Works.
Okay. But spoiler alert, things actually do work.
Yeah, thanks for spoiling our episode. But we have
a nice little pause there. You know, I was trying to get people to be paying attention.
Oh yeah, yeah. Just that pregnant pause.
It
increases the tension and draws.
We're not
people
live.
In.
It's not like we're live on the radio, so it's weird if there's a pause. But it's a podcast.
Yep.
I mean, I tell people to listen to us on 1.5 anyway, speed.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
But anyway, we actually have talked about things that work quite a bit, like cognitive behavioral therapy and drug courts.
CBT.
Yep. But a lot of people still, I think, kind of labor under the impression that rehabilitation doesn't work.
Right.
Or that it's ineffective, or that it's coddling criminals. So why do you think that's the case?
Politicians and the media.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Yeah. That's my answer.
Short and sweet. Yeah.
Short and sweet.
We talked about get tough attitudes in a separate episode.
Yes.
And that, you know, idea certainly runs contrary to ideas of rehabilitation.
Right.
And the historical things that we talked about in get tough might also play a part why people might be under the impression that rehabilitation doesn't work, or they might be opposed to rehabilitation. So specifically in that episode, part of Get Tough ideology is the notion that criminals are bad people and that they're different from us. And part of that message is that criminality is like a fixed, stable trait.
Right.
So if you break the law, you're dangerous, and it's kind of an unchangeable aspect of you.
Yeah, all you have to do is go a little deep. Well, you don't even need to go deep in Facebook comments on any news article that's posted by our local PD. And you can see this represented in the comments section.
But in conjunction to that, or in opposition of that, advocates of rehabilitation believe that people can change and that they can grow, or that they're malleable. And oftentimes bad choices people make are influenced by their bad life circumstances. But I think another myth about rehabilitation is that people who, and this is the myth, that people who believe in rehabilitation believe in some kind of determinism, that people are like compelled to commit crime, or they can't stop themselves from committing crime.
Yeah, so to clarify, a rehabilitative perspective assumes that crime is shaped by deficits or problems in people's lives that are correlated with criminal behavior. And when we think about those deficits, cognitive, educational, vocational, social, criminologists think of them as risk factors, not as determinative causes. So deficits or risk factors are things that influence or shape people's choices and behavior, not force them into criminal activity.
Yeah, good point. In public opinion about criminal justice overall is complicated. And certainly in kind of like straight up questions, people tend to support punitive measures over rehabilitative. But when asked in kind of more nuanced ways, and certainly you're familiar with this, teach about good, asking good questions in research methods.
Yes.
People are a little bit more supportive of rehabilitation. Yeah. So if researchers ask people like, do you like punishment or rehabilitation better? People are going to choose punishment over rehabilitation.
Yeah.
But when people are asked to like rate how important all of these different things are, punishment and rehabilitation, people usually rank rehabilitation pretty high. Punishment is a bit higher, but in a lot of studies that I read, about 70% of the public, when posed that way, kind of support a rehabilitation and think it's an important goal of punishment. Maybe not necessarily the first.
The first, okay.
Like I said, if it's between punishment, let's say like prison or rehabilitation, people are overwhelmingly going to pick punishment, but most people think that rehabilitation is an important part of punishment.
Gotcha.
In prison. Okay. People rate rehabilitation almost as important as punishment in protection when, given the choice between, rating equally multiple options as opposed to like an either or thing.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But the public is much less likely to support rehabilitation for violent offenders. And that is kind of an important aspect of public opinion.
Okay. So you mentioned historical factors influencing attitudes about rehabilitation. Should we talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, for sure. Time machine time.
Time machine.
Okay, here we are back in. We're actually going farther back in time for this episode than we did the Get Tough episode.
Oh, so Zebulon Brockway is going to come up again, right?
Oh, yeah. We're working our way backwards. And we mentioned Zebulon Brockway in our probation episode. We talked about like the reformatory era that introduced indeterminate sentencing and parole.
And his really cool name. Type of things.
Yeah, Zebulon.
Really, mm-hmm. Zebulon.
So the reformatory era, later this idea evolved into the medical model of corrections. So you'll remember that indeterminate sentencing is when judges give you a wide range in sentence that has a minimum and a maximum sentence, and the parole board actually determines when within that range you're released. So this was theorized to promote or incentivize rehabilitation. So the idea is that, parole boards are supposed to make the release decision based on whether you're rehabilitated or not. And so prisoners would seek out treatment and rehabilitation in order to score early release from prison. Score. Yeah. So this is called the medical model because prisons were supposed to function kind of like hospitals. So you sent to prison because you're sick and you're supposed to be, first diagnosed and then treated while you're in prison and then released when you're all better.
Right.
So your prison stay in a rehabilitative model is less tied to what crime you committed and more based on like how many problems you have or issues you have to fix.
Okay. So what went wrong with the medical model? Mm-hmm. We talked in the Get Tough episode about how crime was increasing in the late 60s and early 70s, and people thought that, quote, nothing worked and that rehabilitation was too soft on criminals, and then we got tough on crime. So why wasn't rehabilitation mm-hmm. working?
Well, as we mentioned before, it kind of was working a bit.
Yes.
Martinson definitely overestimated the number and type of programs
that
were not working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also, and we've talked about this issue before, rehabilitation is a science. It's not intuitive like many people think rehabilitation is intuitive. So think about like the, historical penitentiary and reformatory models. The basic assumption there was that we can either kind of like pray the crime away from people or work it out of them.
Yes.
But
the Quaker model.
Yeah. Exactly. Work and pray the crime away.
Yeah.
But there's nothing rehabilitative about solitary confinement or busting rocks all day. Making little rocks out of big rocks all day.
No. In fact, solitary confinement, mm-hmm. caused madness.
Yeah. Makes things worse. Exacerbate your problems. But a lot of times people approach rehabilitation kind of like, well, if you just work them hard enough, or if you make them think about what they've done wrong long enough, or if you get them in a circle and have them talk about their feelings long enough, then that will, cure them and the problems underlining their criminal behavior. Things like, inequality and poverty and unemployment and addiction, family, just, sit in a circle and talk about it.
Yeah.
Things will be
and addiction due to those other things that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Right. So in our drug courts episode, we talked about how these things are not easy problems to solve. So what does work, or how does mm-hmm. rehabilitation work?
So I'm going to talk generally about what aspects of a program make it effective at accomplishing rehabilitation. And then I'll talk about some specific things that work and some things that don't work.
Okay.
So some Canadian criminologist, in the
90s. That's for Diane.
Yeah. Diane, our Canadian super stan, or at least used to be anyway.
She doesn't listen to us anymore. Mm-hmm. It's okay. She's too busy because we keep giving her too much work.
true. But the Canadian criminologist in the 90s created the R&R model, which is the Principles of Effective Rehabilitation. And Paul Gendreau was the guy who kind of led this research, and I actually met him in grad school.
Yeah.
My mentor brought him down to like visit for like a campus visit to South Carolina, and I got invited as like the grad school representative to go out to,
nice.
Go out to dinner with him.
Perfect choice since you're so sociable.
I just sat there kind of like, super formal situation, just like kind of quite
awkward,
embarrassed.
Yeah.
But anyway, R&R stands for risk, needs, and responsivity.
Okay.
And these are the criteria that programs in general should follow to kind of ensure that they're being effective.
To be clear, not TNR, trap, neuter, and release.
Right. R&R. I was trying to think of something funny for neuter and release, but
I think it's funny enough as it is, right? Mm-hmm. You're not trap, neutering, and releasing them, which is
I was trying to think of
option.
Like a replacement for trap with R, something that would be
funny. You're trapping them in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we did chemical castration.
That's right. We got this.
TNR, trap, neuter, and release.
Yes.
But anyway, R&R is risk, needs, and responsivity. So the risk principle, first of all, is that treatment should be targeted to high-risk offenders.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, though, this kind of runs counter to our instincts. So I mentioned before, like, the public is kind of much lower in support of rehabilitating violent offenders. And we talked about with drug courts, like, the eligibility program. So a lot of times, you know, programs kind of limit high-risk offenders or violent offenders because it's like, oh, it might be too...
Selection bias.
Might be not safe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of results in a lot of programs who actually end up excluding the people who need the most help and who need help the most for treatment
be
effective.
Right. Yeah.
And there's actually some research that indicates that putting low-risk offenders in treatment can actually backfire and increase recidivism.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, on the one hand, it might expose them to more criminogenic influences. So, you've got more, like, hardened criminals in the treatment program.
I'm not sure if we defined criminogenic in a previous episode. Okay.
We All have, right. for sure.
So, but we're not going to tell you. Go listen. I don't even remember what episode it was in, though.
I don't either. But we definitely did, because I talked about, like, genesis and generating.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. See if you're paying attention, listeners.
But, I mean, you can kind of figure it out if you're a smart person anyway. Just kind of, like, context clues and hearing what it sounds like. And, of course, all of our listeners are very smart.
Yes, they are. Mm. They're all brilliant.
Yeah. But, like, you know, you put low-risk people in a program with more high-risk people. It's kind of like, you know, peer pressure.
Sure.
In exposing them to, you know, more influential criminals. And then it can also, on the other hand, kind of create like defiance or hostility. And I use this example in classes, like, you know, teaching a college class. If I made all of my students go through like a remedial reading class, they would not be happy about that.
Yes.
And they would not like me. Like this, you know, they would be PO'd and TO'd. Like,
yes.
This is ridiculous. This is stupid. I don't need this. Why are you putting me through this?
Yeah.
So it can actually kind of backfire.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
So high risk, you know, target rehabilitation to high risk offenders. The second is the needs principle,
okay.
and that says that effective treatment should target criminogenic needs.
Yes, okay.
And those are characteristics of people that are related to offending and recidivism that are changeable or that can.
Okay.
Actually be changed.
Okay.
So when we think about like age or history of abuse, those are strongly tied to offending and recidivism, but you can't change those things. You can't do anything about that.
Well, you do get older.
Right, but you can't just like magically age somebody
out of their
crime-prone years.
Right.
You just have to wait, take your time, and wait till that happens. But you can effectively change the three big criminogenic needs that predict recidivism, which are antisocial peers, antisocial personality characteristics, and antisocial attitudes and beliefs.
Okay.
And of course, we talked about antisocial in our psychopath.
We did.
Episode.
Yes.
But it's important to remember that antisocial doesn't mean like not liking to socialize or kind of like weird or shy or awkward. That's kind of how we use it popularly. But you know, when we're talking about here, it kind of means like against society, antisocial. So hanging around with antisocial peers or other people who are involved in drugs, crime, or antisocial behavior, that's a major predictor of crime and recidivism.
Yes.
So programs usually either try to like restructure peer associations, mm-hmm. and that's just a fancy way of saying, like, you know, get people out
get
of
new friends.
Antisocial peer groups. So like employment programs, you can think of like getting a job that takes time away from you hanging out with your antisocial friends.
Yes.
Or mentor programs try to attach you to like a pro-social peer to kind of balance
like
out.
Big brothers, big sisters, which is very popular.
Mm-hmm. And good and effective.
And a good program.
Yep. Antisocial peers, restructure peer associations, or teach people how to resist peer pressure, pressure skills. Antisocial personality characteristics are things like impulsivity, recklessness, deceit, manipulation, aggression, lack of concern for the consequences, those things that we kind of defined as features of antisocial behavior.
And even not that far back, we talked about it in relation to Joker.
Oh, we sure did. Yes. Yeah, for our Halloween spooky episode.
Yes.
Yeah. So antisocial personality characteristics, impulsivity, lack of concern for the consequences. And then antisocial attitudes or beliefs. The third one are kind of like thinking patterns or values that we might hold. Like violence is an acceptable response to frustration, or it's okay to break rules, or it's okay to break the laws, or I was treated unfairly, or somebody else is to blame for my bad behavior.
Yeah, I mean, and we should be clear here that antisocial attitudes and beliefs, children learn those also as children, right? So they learn that violence is an acceptable response to frustration.
Yeah, and, you know, when we talk about kind of like values, that sounds like it's kind of like an explicit thing, but these can be kind of like implicit or unconscious thinking patterns. So if you grow up where your parents are like arguing and fighting, and every time your dad gets mad, he gets drunk or like, you know, punches a hole in the wall, that kind of implicitly teaches you that that's how you react to frustration.
Yeah. I just wanted to put that emphasis on learning there because it's so important.
Yeah. And we've talked about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, before, and about how it's a therapeutic intervention that, you know, emphasizes the way that our cognitions and thinking patterns affect our behavior. So really, it's targeted directly to these two criminogenic needs. It helps people recognize their bad thinking patterns and beliefs, and it teaches them how those affect their behavior and how to control their impulses and kind of recognize the consequences of their behavior. So CBT is effective because it actually tries to change those things that are highly correlated with crime and recidivism and things that can be changed.
Reoccurring theme, CBT.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think personally, I think this is the most important criteria of the R&R model. And I think why oftentimes rehabilitation doesn't work, because programs either like don't have a clear target, let's just sit in a circle and talk about our feelings, or they target things that aren't associated with crime or recidivism.
Right.
And some of my favorite examples are self-esteem.
Yes.
So let's have a self-esteem program. Self-esteem is not a criminogenic need.
No.
So if you have a program to rehabilitate, increase self-esteem, all you're doing is just creating more confident criminals.
Love that.
Yeah. Same thing with art skills and other things. Oh, yeah. Art program. Let's express ourselves through art. Just making more artistic criminals that can draw prettier pictures.
Yes.
But my favorite one of all, and this has been a big fad recently, is the dog training. Dog training
program.
They
also take care of cats, too.
Well,
yeah. It's not.
I didn't know that. I've never seen a cat.
They've taken care of cats as well. It's not part of the rehabilitation because some of the people taking care of these pets are lifers. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're going to be getting out of prison. But they do have cat programs. There's lots of different types of animal programs, not just the dog training. Yes.
I'll have to check that out.
Yes.
But I always ask my classes, you know, like, how many people are in prison because they don't know how to train a dog? And how many people go back to prison because they don't know how to train a dog?
Yes.
But this is the thing, like, dog training programs are super popular because they're, like, cute and cuddly.
Right.
And they make good news stories, and there's, like, pit bulls and parolees TV show.
I did not know that.
Yeah, there's, like, the show's called Pit Bulls and Parolees, and it's, like, a dog training thing. So, like, it's a good picture, like, these hardened, tatted prisoners cuddling these soft, fluffy puppies.
I mean, unless you could turn this into, like, an employment opportunity upon release or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I could see taking that training, dog training that you've learned and starting your own business or, you know, getting a job doing that. But
Right. But the bigger point is that, you know, like, dog training or animal training is not a criminogenic need.
Yeah.
And I am exaggerating here because you could use like these mediums to address those criminogenic needs. Like art therapy could be a way to address
stuff.
Risk, you know, impulsivity and bad thinking patterns. But just art and self-esteem and training a dog in and of themselves, those are not things that, you know, are correlated with crime or recidivism.
Yes.
But like corrections tend to like do these types of programs because they like sound nice and they sound good and they look fun, but you know, they're not kind of based on anything that would actually affect recidivism.
Research isn't there, folks.
Yep. And then finally, responsivity, which is kind of the most abstract, you know, criteria of the model, but it's about matching offender characteristics with treatment approaches. So basically, you don't put people into programs with requirements that they can't meet or handle.
Yeah.
And most simplistically, things like literacy or transportation would be responsivity factors.
Yeah.
So if you're on probation and you have to go to a program and you don't have a car, it doesn't matter how effective the program is. If you can't get there, it's not going to be effective.
Exactly.
Or a program that requires you to like read and write or keep a journal.
Yes.
Even if it's effective, if you don't have those skills, you're not going to be effective in the program.
Right.
But then we can also think about things like, you know, personality development and learning styles and how those like come into play here.
Yes.
So people who have like anxiety and, you know, neuroticism probably wouldn't do so great in like a group therapy setting. So, you know, it can be kind of simple or complex, but it's one of the more less straightforward, more difficult things. So high risk offenders target criminogenic needs and be responsive to offender characteristics. Programs that have those three criteria tend to be more effective at rehabilitation.
Well, got it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you mentioned CBT as an effective therapeutic intervention. Yep. And studies show this is probably the most successful therapy for reducing recidivism.
Right.
Learning and conditioning models, which involve providing disapproval of negative behavior and modeling and reinforcement of appropriate positive behavior, have been shown to be effective at reducing recidivism. Yep. Therapeutic communities, or TCs, where residential treatment provides the context for these interventions, also have been shown to be effective. And we have one of those in our own community.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Have you ever visited Gemeinschaft?
I have.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been there in a really long time. But these are
effective. It's been a few years for me.
Yeah.
As well, but.
These are particularly with drug offenders, they've been effective. Yeah. And these programs emphasize support and accountability among residents.
Right. And one thing to remember is that although I've said rehabilitation is scientific and not intuitive, it's also not super complex. So I remember one time seeing like a CBT workbook for prisoners and thought like, wow, this seems like super simplistic and almost juvenile.
Yeah.
And kind of the learning model that you mentioned above also seems kind of simplistic, like correct bad behavior, model good behavior. But the thing is, you mentioned this before, learning, these are lessons that a lot of us learned in childhood, like self-control, consequences of our behavior, good thinking patterns and values. And a lot of people who were involved in criminal behavior did not learn these lessons. So on the one hand, it is kind of simplistic.
Right. And also you internalize that and it becomes, you're just not aware that those are the reasons why you're doing these things.
Yep.
So on the other hand, it's also important to note that saying rehabilitation is effective doesn't mean it's a cure either.
Right.
Even when good, effective principles and programs, changing behavior and thinking patterns and addictions is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about this a bit in our drug court episode, but effective rehabilitation doesn't mean that everyone who does this program or goes through it's never going to commit a crime again.
Right.
But it means that it has been shown through research that those who do complete this program commit significantly less recidivism than those who don't go through the program.
Yeah, exactly. Great, great point. And I guess the last thing that I want to talk about are some specific things that have been shown to not work and things that have. So in 2000, Congress commissioned a report called the Maryland Report because criminologists at the University of Maryland wrote the report, and it's like one of the Maryland best criminology programs.
Right.
And it was supposed to be a comprehensive report on what does and doesn't work in crime prevention and responses across the board. Mm-hmm. And there was a special section on corrections and rehabilitation. And then a book was released in 2020 that followed up on that report. It basically confirmed, you know, the initial findings. But based on that, and they had like, you know, really specific criteria on how they evaluated something as working. It had to have like, you know, multiple studies showing evidence of effectiveness with like a methodological score, you know, like very high research methods to count something as effective. But anyway, things, you know, that we know do not work include specific deterrence approaches.
Yes.
We talked about that a bit in our Get Tough episode. Maybe we'll do a whole episode on deterrence. That might be a good one.
We should.
Unstructured programs. So I've mentioned this several times, with just like sitting in a circle, talking about your feelings.
And drawing pictures about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Increased control and surveillance. So like heightened surveillance, heightened control doesn't work. And boot camps is also something that, you know, from those reports that, that didn't work. And we don't really hear a lot about boot camps anymore, but like that was kind of a big thing in the 90s. Like boot camps were the new fad on how to, you know, like whip your wayward teen back into shape, but obviously that
the research
work.
I think killed those because they found out that in some cases it could cause the opposite effect, which is that you could make people engage in more high risk behavior by putting them through boot camps.
Yeah, and it's one of those rare things where like the research actually did kind of have an impact. And
yes,
people stopped doing something that
they
didn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But things that do work include incapacitating high-risk, high-rate offenders, cognitive behavioral therapy, which we've talked about a lot.
Right.
Prison-based therapeutic communities. You mentioned and described those earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Vocational and educational programs. Yes. Certainly helping people get an education, get a job can reduce recidivism. Community employment programs. Employment also tied to getting a job. And then finally, drug courts. See our drug court episode. But an interesting fact about that is that in the initial 2000 Maryland report, drug courts were not included as effective, but as it's promising, because this is kind of like when they had first started.
There were
like a few low quality studies that kind of indicated that they might work, but there wasn't enough research out yet to show that they work. So in 2000, drug courts was kind of in the it's promising category. But now, as we mentioned in our drug courts, lots of evidence for the effectiveness of drug courts.
Yay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Way to tie in all these episodes.
Thanks.
They're going to have to go back and listen to our back catalog.
Right. Exactly. So increase our listening to our old episodes.
Yes.
So that's all I've got. You got anything else?
Nope.
All right. Well, that means that it's our Minute to Spin It, where we both give our takeaway from today's show. So what's your spin, Tommy, in just a minute?
Mine's really short.
Mm-hmm.
Rehabilitation works if you're hacking at the root causes of crime.
Yeah.
So the problem is that we're, again, as you mentioned, focusing on the wrong things. And the United States has very high recidivism rates compared to other westernized democracies, industrial nations. And so we need to take a look at what we're doing wrong, and what we're good at, which is mass incarceration, and try a different approach.
Yeah.
We just need to be focused on the right aspects of rehabilitative work.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, what's your spin?
The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. So I know that is the Johnny Cash song.
Yes.
But you probably
know it as
a
Nine Inch Nails. I know it as both, actually, because even Trent Reznor, who wrote the song, said that Johnny Cash just made it completely different and better. It was just like so much better when he covered it. It just like totally changed the tone, and it brilliant. It was just a brilliant cover.
Yeah, that was the other big like song I thought about in terms of rehabilitation.
Yeah.
But also love it as a meme. So like it's my, you know, one of my favorite memes, like when you're 43 years old and sleep the wrong way, and it's Johnny Cash, I hurt myself. Today.
Yes. It's why I kept moving around as we were recording today, because I hurt myself sleeping last night.
Yep.
I don't know how I hurt myself, but I did.
We're at that age.
Yeah.
But rehabilitation does and can work, especially if we're operating on evidence-based principles and, as you said, are actually targeting those research-based criminogenic needs. Giving people a second chance and the skills that they can use to avoid committing crime again is a great way to help people and to make society safer.
We are a community-driven podcast sponsored by the Gandhi Center and produced by JMU Libraries. Check out our website linked in show notes to see how you can support our educational programming. If you make a donation, we'll send you a podcast t-shirt.
Yeah, get some swag.